From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, high-stakes talks between General Motors and the UAW continue as the contract deadline looms.
So you got a lot of different pressures going on here. You have a real clash, and I think they both have legitimate claims here.
Where does most of the money come to run our courts? From fines and fees leveled on defendants. A new report declares that funding system is broken and needs to change.
This is a system that's going to change one way or the other. Michigan either can be a leader and do thoughtful change like the report recommends, or a federal court's going to tell us how to do it.
White nationalist embracing environmentalism. Who are these eco-fascists?
I'm less interested in kind of the way the term is being flung around on social media and more interested in the way in which white nationalists have actually chosen to use this term to describe themselves.
Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The clock is ticking very loudly for bargainers for General Motors and the United Auto Workers Union. Current UAW contracts with all three automakers expire at 11:50 p.m. Saturday. General Motors, of course, the first union target in these contract talks. So once that deadline passes, there are several scenarios. Union leaders could announce a tentative contract agreement. They could extend the existing contract to keep on bargaining, or they could strike some or all of GM's plants. We begin now with Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton, who finds a perfect storm of tariffs, recession fears, slowing sales, and automation costs has led to unhappy union workers.
I'm standing in front of a ghost factory where more than 1,200 UAW members used to clock in every workday to build transmissions for GM cars. Now, the gates here are chained shut, the building is silent, and the acres and acres of parking lots around it sit empty. Earlier this summer, days before the plant shut its doors for the last time, a tearful Danielle Murray talked about what she gave up in wages and benefits to help GM get through bankruptcy in 2009.
I was happy to do so, to save my job, to save the company that I worked for.
She said closing this plant was like a slap in the face.
Now that they're on top and still making record-breaking profits, they're not willing to do that for us, to save us.
Murray isn't being laid off, but she will likely have to upend her life and accept whatever transfer she's offered, even if it's as far away as Tennessee or Texas. Across the country, several thousand other GM workers are facing the same situation. The company has also shut down its plants in Lordstown, Ohio, and Baltimore. Detroit Hamtramck is next on the list. The closures have shaken the union rank and file to its core, and the UAW began sending signals of readiness for a strike months before talks began in earnest. Here's UAW President Gary Jones at the annual bargaining convention in March.
The International Executive Board has decided to raise the strike pay from $200 per week to $250 per week, effective immediately.
There are many other equally thorny issues. Lower pay and benefits for workers hired after 2007. Automation. The automaker's heavy reliance on temporary workers. Nearly 9% of the total workforce at this point. And most of all, stagnation in base pay. Detroit auto workers have only gotten two raises in the past 10 years, and those raises were only 3%. It all adds up to this.
There is a very high probability of a strike.
That's Michael Hicks, an economist at Ball State University, who studies manufacturing trends. He says the union chose General Motors as its target because it's the healthiest of the Detroit three. But he gives the union pretty poor odds of getting the company to agree to an hourly wage hike, even if workers deserve it.
I'm very sympathetic to that argument, but I don't see a real way out for the UAW at this, as we're staring a global recession in the face.
And GM is also facing significant cost headwinds, in part because of the trade war with China. It also needs to spend billions on future technologies like automated cars, investments that likely won't pay off for years to come.
GM's got some uncertain times that it's got to be planning for. The UAW's timing couldn't possibly be worse.
And let's not forget the wild card. That's the ongoing federal corruption investigation of the union. It's led to guilty pleas by five UAW officials so far, and most recently, A high-profile raid of homes owned by the union's current president, Gary Jones, and its former president, Dennis Williams. The corruption probe is almost certain to undermine union workers' trust in their leaders, just when it's needed the most. I'm Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio News.
Let's turn now to Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howe. So, Daniel, the clock is ticking steadily toward that contract deadline of 11:59 p.m. Saturday. How likely is it there'll be a strike?
You know, I keep thinking that there will be one. I think that there's some pent-up anger and a kind of an itch for a fight among the membership. But at the same time, you've got membership that are very concerned about their own leadership. So, you know, but I don't think we'll get a real sense of this probably until sometime on Sunday, maybe. My expectation, I think the expectation at General Motors is that we get close to the deadline on Saturday night, that they extend all contracts for all three automakers, and then they have a meeting on Sunday in the early afternoon of the leadership of the union to basically decide what they're going to do, or to be told by the leadership what they're going to do. And then perhaps, you know, they might extend a little bit more, and then kind of sends the message that we've done everything we could do, and now we're going to go on strike. I don't think it's for certain yet. And if it is, I think that a lot of people would say that's not bargaining in good faith if they're just spoiling for a fight. But if they're really bargaining and they're very involved, and my guess is, and I think the expectation now, I underscore that word, expectation, is that we won't get a lot of clarity till Sunday or Monday, but we'll see.
Okay. So, as you write in your piece this week, timing and circumstances don't help. We know auto sales have been strong. There have been a string of profitable years. Just boil down for us the three big union demands.
Well, I think they want a base wage increase. They always are looking for profit sharing to be enriched to the extent possible. But I think the most important thing is the health care coverage is probably some of the best available in the private sector anywhere in the country. And the irony is here that this union historically has supported Democrats as an institution, and you have Democrats talking about Medicare for all, and I've had interviews with UAW members who scream and yell about, I'm a Democrat, and the Democrats don't understand working folks. The most important thing to me, this one person said, is my health care from General Motors. That is the most important thing.
So that is, as you say, the Holy Trinity. So we heard a GM worker in Tracy Samilton's piece, and I'm sure that feeling is echoed. Workers feel, hey, we bit the bullet to help these companies through bankruptcy. You know, they've had stagnant base pay. So as you write, the union has a point.
They do. I think everybody's got a point here. On the one hand, you know, the union did go through a difficult time. They're now going through another difficult time because General Motors is moving to close four plants in the U.S. and one in Canada. Two of them are already shuttered, one of them in Warren, the other in Lordstown in Northeast Ohio. So they're seeing this happen even as they're getting record profit-sharing payouts the last 3 years. Since 2010, the average UAW member has received more than $80,000 in profit-sharing payments. Over that whole period of time. And in the last 3 years, they've been some of the largest they've ever seen. So they look at this and they say, the company's doing really well. Why are they closing plants? Which I think now gets to the real nub of what the company is facing, and that at General Motors, they got too much plant capacity. And you could argue they didn't close enough plants in bankruptcy. And so now they're looking at a more uncertain future with trade, potential global slowdown in sales in the United States, a lot of next generation technology calls they have to make that are very expensive, and they can't continue to expand the gap between themselves and the foreign automakers operating in the United States. Their structural costs are getting out of whack.
Yeah, you actually, your column earlier this week in the news, tell us about that. For example, for General Motors, when you talk about the cost gap with non-union foreign automakers, what's GM's?
It's about $13 an hour. I think Ford, if I remember my numbers right, was about 11, and I think FCA was 5. So you look at this, and I think a lot of auto executives today would say privately, they're not going to talk about this very much publicly, but they would say, that is unsustainable. General Motors cannot be $13 an hour less competitive than Toyota or Honda or BMW or Mercedes operating in the United States. Yes, those are non-union plants, that is true. They also use a lot more temp workers than the union shops do. Although the union shops do use temp workers, and that's a bone of contention because, of course, the union wants those people to be members of the union and be full-time employees because that benefits them as the union.
Yeah.
So you got a lot of different pressures going on here, and I think that's what's so interesting here is you have a real clash, and I think they both have, as I said in the piece, legitimate claims here, and how they resolve it, they're going to have to resolve it. They can't, like, not resolve it. They're going to have to either have a protracted strike, which I don't expect would actually happen, or a small strike to kind of make the point and then come to an agreement.
In the meantime, as you alluded to when you were talking about all this bargaining, here you've got that widening federal corruption probe. So you have workers who are watching the feds dig into their union leadership and catch some pretty big fish in that net.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is not over. And we at the Detroit News are very involved in reporting the story and been very aggressive on it and will continue to be. This is a very major development. And it's a real overhang here. Because let's play this out just for a quick second. If they go out on strike, what's the one thing you got to do? You got to get the workforce back to work. You got to get them to ratify a deal. So if you've got leadership that people are looking at and saying, geez, these guys are being investigated by the feds. There have been indictments. There have been convictions. There are people in prison. And there could be more, probably will be more. How do we know these guys are telling us the truth? How do we know they're not cutting a deal with management? How do we know all that kind of stuff? So that's one of the things that happens when you send people out on strike is how do you get them back? And the way you get them back is you say, this is a great deal. Here's why it's a great deal. But then if they sit back and say, I don't know if I believe you. And that is a real, and that puts also pressure on GM in this case as well, because whatever deal they put together, it's got to be something that they believe is persuasive enough to get the membership, at least 50.1% of them, to vote in favor of it.
Final few moments, Daniel. What's at stake here if you're not one of the 150,000 workers affected by the talks, mm-hmm. Union members, or a supplier whose business would be hurt by a strike? Why should you care about what happens?
Because it affects the economy. These companies are smaller. They have a lot less employees. Between the three of them, about roughly 150,000 hourly workers across the United States, which is a heck of a lot less than it used to be. But they still are very instrumental in the economy and how people feel about the economy, particularly in places like Michigan. So if all of a sudden you go into a protracted fight, it gets ugly, all these kinds of things, and it also has implications politically as we go into 2020, that's all of that, I think, is pretty much a negative. So it's very easy to say, yesterday's news, nobody cares. These companies are a shadow of what they used to be. They still are some of the largest employers in the state of Michigan and in the Midwest.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks, Daniel.
You bet.
Much more ahead on Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is one of the most instantly recognizable songs ever to be sung on Broadway. That, of course, is from Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cats, which is at the Fisher Theater in Detroit for just a few more days. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here with us. So the show is running till Sunday, and going to see Cats, it's really like going back to the 80s, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is. Yeah, Andrew Lloyd Webber really wowed audiences in the 80s and into the early 90s with the show. It is, how shall we say, a play a lot of people like to hate. It's about cats. There's a very, very thin plot among, wait for it, Cynthia, a clowder of cats.
Never knew that word.
That's one of the collective nouns for felines, unless you prefer a glaring of cats. I think both are excellent. But these cats are in a junkyard, and we meet each one of a different age and markings and specialty. Like, some are better mousers than others. It's kind of all through the night, and so the lighting is really interesting in the show because it sort of takes you all through all those subtle changes of light that have sort of happened through the night. And it's also really more of a musical ballet than musical theater, if you ask me. There's a lot of ballet. There's a bit of tap dancing. And the tap dancing kind of reminds me of my own cats when they try running on a wood floor. So
the dancing is beautiful. The dancing is stunning. Yeah.
Is lovely. But it's almost one of those guilty pleasure shows for people. It's like listening to, I don't know, Celine Dion or Neil Diamond or something like that. It's
hey. Some of us like that. No, I get that. Yeah, there's fans, and we know that I've been seeing posts on Facebook, people that have gone to see it and said, loved it. And it is a kid-friendly show.
Very kid-friendly. It's also a very smart business move because it did have this cult following, even though a lot of people, you know, like to run the show down. And so now all those people that grew up in the 80s and came of age in the 80s with this show, now they have kids and grandkids to take to the show. So it's very smart on the whole, from the point of view of Andrew Lloyd Webber and the producers, to bring the show back.
And now the Wharton Center in East Lansing has a musical that I have been wanting to see since it opened on Broadway.
Yes, it's called Come From Away, and I was lucky enough to see it on Broadway. It arrives this week. Again, it's a play. I would describe it as a play with music. Come From Away is about 9/11, and so this week, as we celebrate the anniversary, timing for the opening is not accidental. The play is about a small town in Newfoundland where so many planes on 9/11 were diverted after the attacks. There were almost 10,000 people, I think, who sat down in a town of about 10,000. And so the story is about the love and the community that formed between the townspeople and these visitors, the relationships that they formed, people who had loved ones who were killed in the attacks and who were missing, the generosity of the people of this town. I mean, they just opened up all their stores and their homes. No questions asked, no payments requested. Even though it took place in Canada, I kind of want to say it's like America in terms of North America. It's America at its best, its best behavior, its best generosity, its best spirit. And here's a quick sample of music from the Broadway cast recording.
American Airlines had the prettiest planes, so I applied as a flight engineer. But the World War II pilots, they all complained. They said girls shouldn't be in the cockpit. Hey, lady, hey, baby, hey, why don't you grab us a drink? And the flight attendants weren't my friends back then. And they said, are you better than us, do you think?
Yeah, that is great. I'm excited to see this show.
It's a terrific show. And you know, Cynthia, this show comes to us at a time when we feel so divided in the country. I feel in some ways that this was the last time we were all together rowing in one direction. I mean, for me, it's like hashtag, this is how we wish we could be all the time. If I could make a really long hashtag. But the music is wonderful. The writing's very good. Highly, highly recommended.
All right. So that is Come From Away at the Wharton Center in East Lansing. And now to the Open Book Theater in Trenton. What are they doing?
They are doing a play that was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize 5 years ago. It's called The Curious Case of the Watson Intelligence. This play by Madeline George, and it's kind of a time-jumping play that examines how we use technology to connect with one another and sometimes disconnect. The title, it comes from how the playwright weaves together four characters all named Watson. So Dr. Watson, the sidekick to Sherlock Holmes, Thomas Watson, the loyal engineer who built Alexander Bell's first telephone, Watson, the supercomputer that became, the reigning Jeopardy champ, and Josh Watson, who is a creation in the play. He's a bit of a techno dweeb, just looking for love that is an invention. He's an invention of the writer, and so It's a very interesting play. I have not seen it. I've read about it. So I'm very curious to see it this Friday.
All right. So just to recap, the Open Book Theater in Trenton, The Curious Case of the Watson Intelligence. Wharton Center has a national touring company of Come From Away. And you got a few more days to catch Cats at the Fisher Theater. Details of these and other productions are always to be found at EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, thanks so much.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Think of environmentalists, and most likely the people that come to your mind are political progressives, people whose views tend to skew toward being liberal. But University of Michigan professor Alexandra Ministern makes a case that more and more white nationalists are latching on to environmental concerns, eco-fascists. Manifestos and screeds associated with recent mass shootings support this. Stern is a professor of American culture, history, and women's studies, and her new book is Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So first of all, ecofascism, what is that? What does that mean?
Well, it's a term that you can find out there pretty easily on social media, and it's being used in politically divergent ways. So some on the left use it to slam those on the right, like national politicians, including Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil or Donald Trump, for basically being climate change deniers and for opting out of international climate agreements. So in that formulation, they're eco-fascist because they're making many people in the developing world suffer the consequences of droughts and famines and floods. Then on the right, it's used by some who view the left as eco-fascists. In other words, that there are leftists who are imposing recycling and making everyone compost. And Greta Thunberg, who has made her way to New York in her kind of, you know, zero carbon boat, is going to take over the world. But I'm less interested in kind of the way the term is being flung around on social media, and more interested in the way in which white nationalists have actually chosen to use this term to describe themselves. So they have seized upon the word ecofascism because it has historical resonances and because it describes their seemingly convoluted approach to preserving the white race, which they equate with preserving nature.
Walk us through that reasoning, if you can.
Yeah. So a good way to start thinking about the reasoning is really kind of the logic of pollution. So from their perspective, non-white people are polluting American society through their race, through their ethnicity, through their culture and their customs, and they are potentially turning whites into a despised minority. So they are would be, like in the lingo of white nationalists, you know, quote, illegal aliens, unquote, would be associated with pollution. Then that analogy is taken and thought about also in the context of nature. So that nature is being polluted, is being overtaken by alien species, invasive species. And it is the role of white men to protect America, or at least as much of America as they can, from this pollution. So if you see it through the lens of pollution, we can understand, for example, why in the El Paso shooter's four-page manifesto, why was he talking about the Lorax? Why was he talking about single-use plastics?
And the Lorax was the Dr. Seuss story.
The Dr. Yes. Seuss story that's about deforestation and corporate greed. And the shooter praised it as an American classic and as a story to be mindful of and so on and so forth. So really, it's that kind of logic of pollution helps us understand it.
And the Christchurch, New Zealand shooter, there was some kind of environmental
exactly.
expression, too.
So both of those shooters called themselves eco-fascists.
And I guess we will say a lead shooter for El Paso.
So the lead shooters called themselves mm-hmm. eco-fascists in their manifestos. And that they didn't pull that word out of thin air. That word actually has a history. So there's a longer history of parts of the environmental movement in the United States and beyond being tinged with xenophobia and racism, again, along this idea of, you know, protecting the superior species from the invasive species, whether it's plants or people. And we have a Michigan example of that, actually. I don't know if you recognize the name John Tanton. John Tanton, he passed away recently, and he started the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and was very much of kind of a xenophobe and an anti-immigrationist. Mm-hmm. And he also was very much enmeshed in the environmental movement. So he is representative of a certain strand of xenophobes that tried to commandeer environmental groups in the 1990s, for example, in the United States, when there was a big skirmish in the Sierra Club about whether environmental protection should be linked to overpopulation, should be linked to immigration control. So that is a strand that has been around since the early 20th century, when well-known eugenicists gravitated towards preservation of bison and redwood trees. It's been there. It also, though, ecofascism has links to Nazi Germany.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to go there. As you're talking about this, I feel I'm hearing echoes of the 1930s in Europe.
You are indeed. And, you know, the ideas there are ideas of racial purity and purity of nature and purity of people. And there were various manifestations that played into kind of thinking in the Third Reich that had to do with a veneration of this ideal kind of nature of the Aryan fatherland. Think also of these images of the, you know, the barbarian forests, mm-hmm. and the castles. And, you know, so it's very romantic and nostalgic at the same time that it has a very kind of deadly and exclusionary edge to it.
Is that where Blood and Soil, that slogan?
Exactly. So from Blood and Soil plays into that. So when you think of Blood and Soil, you also need to think about the environmental aspects of it.
You don't have to look very hard on the internet to find these eco-fascist images and forums and threads, do you?
No, you don't. First of all, you can Google it, and you can see that there's been some more recent attention of journalists and scholars to understanding this development and being concerned about it. Mm-hmm. If you dive into platforms like Reddit, or particularly 4chan, 8chan, or Gab, but you can also just go to Twitter, but you will find those who identify as ecofascists, those who use some of the emojis and symbols associated with ecofascism, those who use some of the slogans, which are trees, not refugees, would be one of the slogans that you might find on the internet that kind of captures some of the ideas we've been talking about.
You've written a piece about this for The Conversation, and in that piece you say partisan labels don't apply here. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is what you discussed in the intro to our discussion, which is that when we think of, you know, it's a very interesting political moment in the United States right now, where we have a standing president who can understandably be accused of enabling white supremacy because of what he tweets, because of what he says, because of some of the policies that he's enacted. But that doesn't mean that white nationalists are in lockstep with Donald Trump and support everything he does. In fact, many of them are wary of him, don't trust him, and don't think he's done enough. And one of the ways in which they diverge from him, at least this sizable contingent that would identify as eco-fascist, is around environmental issues. So they reject his climate, you know, denialism. They reject his loosening of environmental protections. And instead, they want to recast those kind of policies or those approaches, but wrap them around kind of a flag of white supremacy or the idea of returning to a white supermajority in the United States.
Why do we need to care about a comparatively small number of these white supremacist, white power eco-fascists?
Yeah, I would say that what we've seen over the past few years is that what is on the fringe can certainly move to the center, and we need to be very concerned about that and concerned about the way in which media ecosystems, particularly social media, allows that to happen. So that's one issue.
But we do live in a country where free speech is constitutionally protected.
But it still means that we should be aware of, you know, what is moving through, you know, these internet channels, what is moving through these echo chambers, and what potential effects they could have on people with violent intentions. And that's where thinking about how did this influence, how did these ideas, they might not have been the main driving idea, but they were ecofascism as part of the package that motivated the Christchurch shooter and the El Paso shooter and, you know, others who have carried out racially motivated violence. But another reason to be concerned about it is that both, as you know, ecofascists look towards the past, but they're also very much looking towards the future. And what they see is a future where there are two intertwined trends that are happening. One is that climate change is happening and it is producing more refugees, more displacements of people, and that is going to, in their eyes, disrupt the racial order further and potentially jeopardize white minorities, or what is becoming a white minority in the United States. At the same time, we know, and related to that, we know by looking at census projections that 2045 is that target date when whites will become a minority alongside other ethno-racial groups in the United States and will no longer have numerical predominance. So in the eyes of white nationalists, or I guess in the ears of white nationalists, that demographic clock is ticking every single day and incites panic and anxiety and is part of the way in which they weave these narratives, these really apocalyptic narratives of change in American society. And those narratives can be compelling, and they can be compelling to young people who are concerned about young white people who might be drawn in some way to, quote, white identity politics, end quote, and also to environmental concerns.
University of Michigan professor Alexandra Minna-Stern. Her new book is Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. And she'll be speaking Monday, September 16th at 7 p.m. at Literati in Ann Arbor. And you can also find her piece on the white nationalist extreme solution to the coming environmental apocalypse by going to theconversation.com. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Still to come, reforming the way that we fund our trial courts. That is next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In Michigan, residents who appear in court will face judges who rely on money from those defendants to make their budgets work. That works out to criminal defendants being fined more than $418 million in fines and fees every year. Well, according to the final report out today from the Trial Court Funding Commission, the unanimous conclusion is this funding system is broken. So, what fixes are needed for our courts in Michigan? Well, let's find out now as we welcome back the chair of the Trial Court Funding Commission, Ingham County District Judge Thomas Boyd. Judge Boyd, always great to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Judge, the final report out today breaks down funding for our trial courts and shows more than 26% of the court budgets are generated by issuing fines and fees to defendants. Explain for us why this is a problem.
Well, the real concept is, can the judge, he or she, really be fair, not only be fair, but appear to be fair when the decision is related to the amount of money the court will have to operate? If your daughter is a college student here at Michigan State and they wander into my jurisdiction and get charged with a minor offense, a misdemeanor offense, and they come home and say, Mom, Dad, I didn't do it. When I hear that case, do you really want me to be thinking, you know, geez, if she's not guilty, I don't get any money out of this case. The standard that judges are held to by the United States Supreme Court is to avoid the appearance of an impropriety. In that system I just described to you, it might appear to some people that I have a dual motive or a conflict of interest. That's what we need to avoid.
I need to avoid that. And for defendants standing before you who are low income, how does that land on them?
In Michigan, there are rules for determining the ability to pay before sending someone to jail. Whether those rules are evenly applied or applied to people who aren't going to jail but simply face consequences of a motor vehicle infraction or some minor criminal endeavor, those are where the conflict lies. And again, if the judge is responsible for making sure that their city or their township or their county has enough money to pay for the court, that puts in their mind that this conflict of, am I supposed to make a determination based on the evidence in front of me, or do I have this responsibility to make sure there's enough money to fund the court? And unfortunately, in Michigan, there are multiple examples of mayors and township supervisors and other people from government saying, you know, if your revenue doesn't go up, we're going to lay off one of your staff.
The commission looked at this in depth over the last couple of years, and your final report is out today with some recommendations, the first being to have the state accept more responsibility for court funding. First off, what does the state cover now?
About 70% of the money used to operate the trial courts in Michigan comes from local sources. That's a combination of property tax, local general fund revenue, and funds that you mentioned earlier, generated by the court and turned over to the local unit to operate. The balance, the 30% remaining, is 7% from federal funding sources, grants, and other things like that, and then money from the state. However, a huge caveat is about $100 million of the money currently coming from the state to the trial courts actually originated with the trial courts, went to the state, and then they just give it back.
Oh, good heavens.
So the state share is actually pretty low right now.
So what does the report recommend in terms of more state involvement?
Well, the state stepping up its responsibility to be a more equal partner in the funding of the state trial court system is really underlies several of the recommendations. The first recommendation is that all of the money that comes into the trial courts go to the state and then to be redistributed to the trial courts, not based on how much each trial court brings in, but how much each trial court actually needs to operate. The point there is to create a disincentive or to remove the improper incentive to build revenue needlessly. If my court had a 2x revenue, meaning we cost $2 million to operate and we brought in $4 million, there would be no benefit to me or my court to have that extra $2 million. The incentive to take more money from the people than is necessary or than is appropriate would be gone. So that's the first recommendation. There will be a spillover there into law enforcement, because if money that's currently coming to the trial courts going to law enforcement is now not there, there would be no incentive to have a speed trap or other law enforcement that's just designed to enhance revenue. Now, you may need to have a speed trap or an enhanced enforcement zone if it's dangerous, but you would only do it because it's dangerous. Now, today, lots of people believe that speed traps exist to make more money for the city. Unfortunately, sometimes that's true. So the first recommendation for the Trial Court Funding Commission would fix that, would remove that improper incentive. The second is that the state offer and pay for a statewide data management system. Keeping track of court files, moving to electronic filing, these are all real parts of our life here as operators of courts. If the state were the provider at the state expense of all that technology, not only would we have better data, not only would we have a better history and better records, but that would shift more of the expense from the communities to the state. The third recommendation is to have the state take over collection of debts to the courts. There's three real reasons this makes sense. First is, other states that have done it have had an increase in revenue at a lower cost. Second is, courts aren't really good at this. Every court has a huge multi-million dollar receivable, is what we would call it if we're a business, meaning people owe us money and we're not great at collecting it. Third is, the way we collect it is by putting people in jail. So a couple of years ago, the folks at Michigan State University's law school helped us do a study, and they determined that for every time someone owes me money and I issue a warrant for their arrest, between the time I issue the warrant for their arrest and that person is standing back in front of me under arrest, we spend $130. Now, if that person only owes us $100, we've just lost money. If that person can only afford to pay $100, we've just lost money. We're not good at this. So those are the three reasons that it makes sense to have the state take over collections.
It sounds like it's more efficient, but you also believe this would make our courts more fair?
It would make our courts more fair. It would make our jails less overcrowded. It would be a much wiser way to spend local revenue.
If the state gets more involved with court funding, there is the potential for, you know the word, politics. How much of a concern would politics be in doing this?
First of all, there's politics already. It's just that there's good politics or good relationships and troubled relationships. So I have a great relationship with the Ingham County Commission. They're very supportive of what we do here. And so there are no funding fights because of political issues. Other communities may not have a good relationship with their funding unit. Recently, the controller of Saginaw County sent a letter to his judges that says, you know what, we need to save money, and it occurs to us that your state employees were cutting your health care benefits. So politics, plays out. So the question is, in Kansas, those politics are at the state level, and they battle back and forth. What I can tell you is that that's a cautionary tale, but the Michigan State Legislature already funds the judicial branch at the top level. All of the judges are already paid for by the state. The Supreme Court, which is where they had trouble with Kansas, paid for by the state, paid for by the legislative branch. So there is always a possibility of politics getting involved in our state, as I suggested in Saginaw. But the question then becomes, is there a way to control for it? Our recommendations balances the continued local investment with new increased state investment. So it never flips one way or the other. We're not arguing for a state takeover of the trial courts. We're just arguing for or suggesting and recommending a balancing, a shift a little more on the state so they can accept the responsibilities, and then doing things smarter, like taking away the incentives from courts and police to try, do profit-motivated judging and policing, taking away the responsibility from courts to jail people because they owe money.
I'm speaking with Ingham County District Judge Tom Boyd, who is the chair of the Trial Court Funding Commission, out today with the final report on ways to fix what they call the broken trial court funding system in Michigan. Judge, the report outlines in great detail where and how to start making these recommended fixes. These seem like pretty big lifts. Not only do they require legislation, in some cases there's whole changes in culture from the way things have always been done. And that's hard. What is the path forward from here?
You know, we've had really encouraging conversations with legislative leaders. We really believe that the legislative committees responsible for this type of change are going to look at these recommendations seriously. Really important, earlier this year, the Michigan State Supreme Court, in a case entitled People versus Cameron, looked at two constitutional challenges to our court funding system. Now, in that case, they did not accept either of those two technical constitutional challenges. However, in a concurring opinion, the Chief Justice wrote that the conflicts pointed out by other parties in that litigation or people outside that litigation may be real, specifically pointing out to the same kind of problems we're talking about in the Trial Court Funding Commission report. She went so far as to say the legislature ought to read the recommendations of the Trial Court Funding Commission report and take action on them before the challenges we address are brought back to the court. She strongly suggests that the court might rule our current system unconstitutional. On those challenges. So the point is, we are at a moment in history where all across the country, these financing structures are being challenged and are falling. The question is, can Michigan get out in front of it and fix it before there's a crisis?
Almost all the recommendations in your final report not only require legislative action, but there's the need for more state funding. How much more state money do you think we're talking about that would be needed at the end of the day to do this right?
Well, you know, it's really unclear because consistent with the Supreme Court's decision of People versus Cameron, is the system is going to continue to charge defendants. Hmm. That is not changing, and that's not recommended to change. So the money that's there will continue to be there by and large. So it's not like we're saying that the system should not ask the defendants to pay. That's going to be the law. Cameron made that clear. The question then is what happens with that money when it's in the system? I do believe that there will be a shortfall when judges are only assessing the right amount as opposed to the profit-motivated amount. How much will that shortfall be? I don't really know. I think that it's safe to say it will be a lot of money, maybe as much as $100, $125 million a year. So yes, I believe the state needs to step up and invest a little more money here. We can't say exactly how much because there's no way to tell how much of a problem we'll be fixing here. And that's exactly what that $100 to $125 million is, and that's the problem that we're fixing here.
Now, for folks listening to us talk who have never been inside a courtroom, they do not envision any time at all when they would be standing before you in some kind of legal difficulty. They may be asking, why should my $100 to $125 million in tax dollars go to improve court funding? What do you say?
Fundamental to the American system of government is due process, equal protection, and fairness before the court. When jurors come in and we explain to them that our system of self-government could not exist without their service, what we're saying is that fairness is fundamental to the system. Too many people listening to this broadcast, too many people worried about what might happen to them the next time they go to court or what might happen to other people they know, don't believe the system's fair.
they don't believe that they're going to get a fair shake because the judge is motivated by money or because the police officer is motivated by something improper. Everything is at stake if people don't believe the government is fair. And I think it's safe to say that a good percentage of the people listening to your broadcast today have some doubts that the system is fair. So, do we need to spend money, even if it's a lot of money, to assure the system's fair? We do. We're spending it now. The amount of money we spend to operate the trial courts in Michigan is $1.1 to $1.4 billion, billion with a B, each year. We're not going to spend more. It's just this question is where that money's coming from. There's no proposal to spend more money. As a matter of fact, several of our proposals will save money. So it's not a question of should the people pay more. It's the question is what should we do with the money we have now? This is a long-term project. Our reports could easily take, you know, 6, 9, 12 years to be rolled out and totally implemented. Just last month, the United States Circuit Court for the Fifth Circuit decided in a case named Callista versus Contrell that a system of financing which was very much like Michigan's was totally unconstitutional. So this is a system that's going to change one way or the other. Michigan either can be a leader and do thoughtful change like the report recommends, or a federal court's going to tell us how to do it differently someday in the future with a lot less control by the people of Michigan.
Ingham County District Judge Tom Boyd, who's chair of the Trial Court Funding Commission, out today with its final report proposing reforms to our trial court funding system. Judge Boyd, always a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Abortion has moved to the forefront of our national politics. Where lawmakers stand on the issue has become a litmus test when determining if someone is Republican or Democrat. But it hasn't always been this way. Michigan Public Radio Network's Shana Roth, as part of a joint project with the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, reports the political shift started around 1980.
With a deep awareness of the responsibility conferred by your trust, I accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States.
1980 in Detroit. Republican candidate Ronald Reagan accepts the party's nomination for president, and Republicans add a new plank to their platform. It reads, quote, "We affirm our support of a constitutional amendment to restore protection of the right to life for unborn children." Right to Life of Michigan helped create that language that started a lasting shift toward an anti-abortion agenda. But while Republicans in Michigan and nationwide largely adopted the anti-abortion platform, Democrats did not instantly all become pro-choice, although it was part of their platform. In 1985, Right to Life of Michigan endorsed a pro-life Democrat for a crucial special election seat in the state Senate. Adrian Hemond is with Grassroots Midwest, a bipartisan political consulting firm. He says the same organization supporting a Democrat today in such a key race seems almost impossible.
Democrats don't seek Right to Life's endorsement and wouldn't accept it if it were offered. And the same thing largely goes for Republicans, even if they support, you know, some abortion rights. Accepting an endorsement from, say, Planned Parenthood is politically poisonous.
In the last 8 years, there has been a dramatic change in the number of Democrats supported by Right to Life in legislative races. 35 Democrats were supported in 2010, but only 2 in 2018. In contrast, Right to Life supported 137 Republican candidates last year. Lori Carpentier is the president of Planned Parenthood of Michigan. She says the issue and the divide between Republicans and Democrats today is, quote, on steroids.
We are in a place now where there are very few anti-choice Democrats, but there are virtually no pro-choice Republicans. And I think we have gotten to a place where we can't even have discourse.
Both Planned Parenthood and Right to Life have used this divide and the emotions around the issue to increase the amount of money they raise. However, the impact of all that money is difficult to gauge. Barbara Listing has been president of Right to Life of Michigan since 1981. She says their influence in any single election is small.
We just find that we need to get our people to the polls and vote for our candidates.
But donations increase dramatically every election year. In some years, Right to Life's Political Action Committee's account has gone down to zero, only to go up to more than $200,000 the following election year. It's similar with Planned Parenthood, though not as dramatic. The political parties today use a candidate's position on abortion as part of determining their acceptance to the party. The endorsements of Right to Life and Planned Parenthood can sometimes make or break a candidate, especially in a primary. But Right to Life and Planned Parenthood say they aren't being used by the Republicans and Democrats that support them to essentially funnel more money toward their respective political party. Both say they'd like to endorse either party. Before the 1980s, there was a bipartisan pro-choice caucus in the Michigan legislature, made up of Republicans and Democrats. The odds of that happening again are slim. Heman says we are now seeing the result of that natural realignment that began in the 1980s, where abortion went from a boutique issue to a concerted effort by Republicans, especially religious Republicans, to capture those votes. But he says the country has also just become more divided.
Whether you identify yourself as pro-life or pro-choice is one of those cultural totems that we have divided ourselves along now. And so that makes it even more partisan. You're one of those people, not one of our people.
Abortion will likely be a key issue for the 2020 election for both parties, and the endorsements of Right to Life and Planned Parenthood could be key in primaries and general elections. I'm Shayna Roth in Lansing.
And that's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.